Decisive battles fought during World War II have captured the attention of Americans for decades. Names like Iwo Jima and Guadalcanal and Normandy have slipped into the language, becoming synonymous with bravery and patriotism. Hello, and welcome to Hometown Alaska. I'm your host, Ellen Lockyer, and today we'll be talking to two World War II veterans who actually faced combat in both the Pacific and the European theaters. Let's meet our guests, Jack Fuller. Hi, Jack.
You.
Hello, Jack. Jack fought with the Marines in the Pacific, and Ira Ryan.
Hi.
Ira fought with the U.S. Army Infantry in Europe. So first, let's get some background on the U.S. Marines and why they stand out from other branches of the military. Jack, what is a Marine?
Well, I think they say that we have the greatest publicity in the world, but we take with a grain of salt because I think we are trained. We have one of the best training programs of any military organization in the world. And that, I think, is one of the reasons that the Marines do as well as they do, because we are trained before we go in. That doesn't always happen. It didn't happen in World War II. A lot of young people were killed simply because they were not trained well enough.
Mm-hmm. And the Marines did fight in Iwo Jima in 1945. I did a little Google search, and the Marines were, for those of you who like the trivia, the Marines were founded in Philadelphia in 1775, and November 10th is their birthday. And they were founded at the Tun Tavern in Philadelphia by a fellow named Samuel Nicholas. And they still exist to this day and have...
Go ahead. We celebrate that birthday, too, even if we don't have a... organized unit, usually the Marine Corps League, which is like the American Legion and VFW, always recognized has a birthday at that time celebration. And out in the Wasilla area where I'm at, the AMVETS, about three or four Marines get together and put on a Marine Corps birthday. And that's when the oldest... Marine is given a piece of cake cut by the youngest Marine, and that's a tradition that we follow. And although we don't have organized units there, we still go through that ceremony.
Holy mackerel! Well, and the Marines, of course, were instrumental in taking Iwo Jima in World War II, and we'll get back to that in a minute. But I didn't want to leave Ira here out because he fought with the U.S. Army Infantry in Normandy Beach in Europe.
That's right.
Holy mackerel. Can you, going to ask both of you, and you can answer this separately. First of all, one of the reasons we were even doing this program is because of the HBO miniseries, The Pacific Theater, and the one they had a year or so ago, Band of Brothers, which focused on World War II action. And first of all, how do you feel about the experiences that you lived through that were certainly not entertaining at the time being used as an entertainment medium on television?
Well, frankly, the way I look at it, it kind of teaches the civilian population exactly what it was like during the war. It's like this photograph I have here. If I show that, they say, well, which one are you? And that, when we were, 18 when we went in? And yeah. I'm in 86 now. And they look at me and they say, you were never young.
Yes, you were. Jack is, Ira Ryan is speaking. And he did bring us a beautiful black and white photo of himself and four of his buddies in World War II uniform taken, I believe, in Europe. And that will be on our website, and this would be probably a good time to remind our listeners that You can find links to today's topics on KSKA.org. You'll be seeing some pictures and some website links that will give you more information about World War II. And Hometown Alaska is a call-in program, so if you'd like to call in and make comments or speak with our guests, you can call 550-8433. That's 550-8433 in Anchorage. Outside of town, 1-888-353-5752. That's 888-353-5752. Or email us at hometownalaska@kska.org. So getting back to Jack and Ira here, you brought up a good point there, Ira. You were pretty young. You were, what, 18 when you – were you drafted or did you join voluntarily?
Well, I signed and volunteered for the draft, so you might as well say I enlisted. And once they had me, it was just, once you were accepted, you were in.
And you were 18 or 17?
18.
18. And did you have any idea what that path would take you down?
Well, who really knew what we were putting in for, you know? We were all gung-ho. The war was on, and we were sitting there in town not doing anything. And as a matter of fact, I had, they took me in February, and I was due to graduate from high school in June. But I had enough credits. So, as a matter of fact, I was in a hole in the ground in Louisiana. We were there for the fall maneuvers. And the mail guy come by, and he said, "Here, you got something." And he threw my diploma in the hole to me. So at least I graduated from high school.
Yeah, well, that's cool. How about you, Jack? Did you enlist?
Yes, I tried to get into the British, the Canadian Air Force when they were first starting in that war, and I did not have enough math, or I wasn't bright enough or something, but I was too big to be a gunner. So the three of us that went over to Canada to try to join, one of them, Jack Webb, he became a pilot and actually was shot down in the Battle of Britain. Mm-hmm. But I couldn't get, at that time, right after that, I tried to join our Air Force. And that was Jefferson Barracks, Missouri, if I recall. And it was so lined up with so many people that wanted to join, I walked downstairs and enlisted a 4-year enlistment in the Marine Corps, which I didn't know anything about, but I learned real
but
fast.
You learned fast. And it is a point, though, that you had that sense of patriotism and duty to support the government.
Well, I tried to, like I say, join the Canadian Air Force at the war time, but couldn't make it.
Right. Well, let's go to the phones. Line one. Stu, you're on air.
Oh, thanks for taking my call. It's an honor, Jack and Ira, to hear you guys on the radio. I have a question for Jack. Clint Eastwood came out with a couple of movies not too long ago, Letters from Iwo Jima, which was the Japanese side of the battle, and Flags of Our Fathers. And I was just wondering if Jack saw them and if he had any comments.
Well, I saw them, and actually the guy that wrote his dad was one of the flag raiders on the corpsman. I met him in Connecticut a few years ago, and he was getting ready to write that book. But I've seen them both, and I think they're as well done as you can do something like that. Like we were talking a minute ago, the command sergeant major and I, that it's combat is something that you can't tell someone what it's all about. Either you're in it and you experience, or it's very difficult to actually display what really goes on. But I think in this time of hype and everything, I think they did a pretty good job on it. I would give it a plus.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Stu. Thank you for calling. So how about the reality? You fought, Jack, on Iwo Jima. Now, that is, of course, one of the iconic moments in World War II. It's gone down in history. There's a famous photograph of the Marines raising the flag. It's just, you know, you see it and you see it and you see it. What was it really like?
There was three Marine divisions there, the 3rd, 4th, and the 5th. And a Marine division at that time was around roughly 25,000 people. The total casualties of the Marines and the Navy, and that includes those that landed the Higgins boats who were running up to the beach, was over 27,000, I think. So it was the toughest campaign that the Marines had ever fought. And about the first week, I think there was 7,000 casualties, and 3,000 people were killed. So it was just a problem that you just went high, dead a little up the middle, and they were in caves, and they had all the advantage.
Well, apparently, and I don't know, except for what I've Google searched, the Japanese, they had control of the island. They were, they had sort of booby-trapped the island. They had these tunnels and bunkers underneath this Mount Suribachi. And the Marines were sent to capture the airfields to help break that Japanese control of the Pacific.
My division was the 3rd Marine Division, and we were the ones that went up the middle. We finally... the 5th was on the left, and the 4th was on the right. And the problem there was that these people were in holes, tunnels, communications. They never had to expose themselves. So it was just a matter of taking 1 foot at a time. I mean, it's. I think after the first 2 weeks, we had only gone about 4,000 meters, and they had the advantage, and mm-hmm. they had a good general.
And you were there 36 days, right?
Yeah. From the first day, we started in. My battalion was the 21st Regiment, 1st Battalion, and after the first 24 hours, the Marine Corps commanding general realized that he needed the reserves. We were in reserve, the 3rd Marine Division. So my battalion went in the first day, but it was so rough that we were in, I think, about 7 hours and went back to the ship. And it was so rough, we lost people going down the cargo nets and everything. But then finally, the second day, we were up on the airstrip number one. And that's the way my division went, from there all up the center of the island, which was one of the most heavily fortified and some of the best soldiers that they had.
Yeah, and you told me earlier that when you enlisted in the Marines, you know, the training wasn't all that great. Did you have any idea going in what?
No, I don't want that. That's not exactly what I said.
Okay.
I said the replacements, were the ones that, but the people originally going through boot camp with the mm-hmm. time that they had, and then be able to train with the company and train with the division before you go over is a big advantage. But at Iwo, we got a lot of young people that had practically been just out of boot camp and didn't mm-hmm. have training. That's what I was talking
okay.
about.
Okay, I'm glad to clarify that. How old were you at Iwo?
I was 19, I believe.
Wow.
I'm 88 now, going on 89.
Okay, and how about, I want to get to Ira just a moment, because you're restless in your chair, and you were on Normandy Beach, right?
Yeah, but could I add something
sure, go ahead.
Regarding, I always thank God that I wasn't sent to the Pacific. I mean, because the mindset of the Japanese against the Germans. The Japanese didn't, it was against their honor to surrender.
Mm-hmm.
But the Germans would fight to a certain point when they realized that that's it, they give up. And Japanese were captured there in the island? Not that many, were there?
No. They had over 20,000 troops at Iwo, and I believe that there was something like 100, and a lot of them were not really Jap. They were, a lot of them were Korean workers. And stuff.
Oh.
I mean, but the regular Japanese, he thought it was better to die for the emperor.
Okay. They'd suicide themselves.
Yeah. Really? So let's talk about Normandy for a little bit, because you were telling me earlier, Ira, that the depiction of the invasion, the D-Day invasion, you see it in the movies, isn't quite accurate. You were telling me about how the smaller spaces and the open spaces were all flooded.
You want to remember that I didn't go in the first, say, five or six waves. We were landed in the afternoon after they had moved the beach back. So it was somebody said they're trying to describe combat to them. When you hear that first bullet go whizzing past your ear, you know that there's a shell coming in. You know that you're in combat.
Uh-huh.
So the area that we were in was down in Carentan and had been flooded by the Germans. So it was... I was originally supposed to go to the 4th Infantry Division. But I'm laying in a hole at the top of an apple orchard, and I got hit in the leg with some shrapnel.
Uh-huh.
So they held me in aid station for about a week till they cleared up. I'm surprised they didn't evacuate me. But there weren't that many replacements coming in. So, and then I got sent to the 83rd Division, the L Company, 331st Infantry.
Mm-hmm.
And we're talking about surrendering. After we get out of Normandy into Brittany, they surprised we cut off, Patton had cut off the German escape, and there were 10,000 Germans surrendered at one time to this lieutenant.
What did he do with them all?
Just keep sending them back. They sent them back. England didn't want them. They were overloaded as it was.
Uh-huh.
So they sent most of them back here to the States.
The prisoners.
Yeah, prisoners.
Oh, I didn't know that. Now, you are wearing around your neck there a medal of some kind?
Well, it's a coin.
Uh-huh.
It's a Purple Heart coin.
Uh-huh.
So... I got one in Normandy and then one later on in the Bulge.
You were in the Battle of the Bulge, too?
Yep.
Oh, my word. You got around. What was your position? What were you doing?
I was a rifleman.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
A grunt.
A grunt. That is amazing to me that you went from this sort of normal, you both are from upstate New York, western New York, fairly rural areas, you know, small towns, small farms, and you went from these sort of small American town teenagers to these momentous battles. How did you handle it? I mean, how do you do that?
I grew up in Detroit. I just told you I was, when you said you were from New York, I said I was born in New York.
Oh, you were born there.
But actually.
But still.
Yes, well, I young people were not faced with all the things that these young people are today. And while we're at this, I would like to say something about the young soldiers that are over there doing their bit. I think that it's we've got two people here that have been through the mill as riflemen, and I think we both agree that these young people today have a much tougher road to hoe than we did. I mean, when you almost tie your hands up shooting the enemy, I mean, it was easy for us. We knew who they were, and that was all there was to it. But now these people are risking their lives, and I wonder if a lot of that isn't what's making these young people sort of have so much problems with their mind.
You mean the young people involved in the military action overseas?
Yes, young volunteers. Yeah. And we got to remember that these are all volunteers.
Well, yeah, go ahead.
When we were younger, we had radio, no television, so our mind wasn't molded like television molds the kids today.
Mm-hmm. True.
And then there's when I went to Normandy, nobody said to me, "You can't shoot. If somebody shoots you, you shoot back." And over there, they're more worried about friendly fire killing civilians. Then, geez, I'll bet when we went to Normandy, they killed thousands of Frenchmen and nobody questioned it.
Really?
If they were there, bang. And it was the same way in Korea. And to a point in Nam, it was the same way. Nobody really said, "Watch out, don't shoot there, there's friendly civilians there."
Okay, well, I'm going to remind our listeners that Ira here was also involved in the Korean War and in the Vietnam War.
I served 31 years continuously in the military.
And I have let's pause 1 minute to remind our listeners that this is Hometown Alaska and it is a call-in show. So if you would like to talk with either of our guests or make a comment, please call 550-8433 in Anchorage. That's 550-8433. Outside of Anchorage, 1-888-353-5752, 1-888-353-5752. Or you can email us at hometownalaska@kska.org. And remember that links to today's program theme can be found at KSKA's own website, kska.org. We are talking about two World War II veterans, both from who have fought in the Pacific Theater and the European Theater during World War II. So, Jack, you had something you wanted to remind people.
Yes, while we're still talking about the younger people, I'd like to put a pitch in here, if I may. I would like to invite everyone at the Sportsman Show to stop by the Wounded Vets Rifle Raffle. Buy a ticket from veteran Bill Lyle, who has run the raffle for the last 6 years. Thanks for the help of the SFW, the SGI, and the Combat Fishing, and the AMVETS Legion, and VFW. I hope you will support this. Thank you very much for the young wounded vet.
And that would be at the Sportsman's Show going on this
Thursday,
weekend?
Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday.
And that's at the Sullivan Arena. And so there is a wounded vets benefit raffle.
Yes.
And they've got a booth there. Okay,
yes.
Good. How about you, Ira?
I'm on the Retired Council and the Military Order of the Purple Heart.
Uh-huh.
And I'd like to get a lot more retired people get involved into the Retired Council. And also, probably we have right now 14 members on the Military Order of the Purple Heart, and there's probably 50 of them in town. Maybe they aren't joiners, but we could use their help.
So tell us about what the Military Order of the Purple Heart is. I wasn't aware of it until just the other day.
Oh, my goodness.
I know what the Purple Heart is, but I didn't know that there was a whole organization.
I should have bought a couple. I've got a couple of magazines,
okay,
to you. If you have been wounded in combat and get the Purple Heart, you don't automatically become a member of the military order. You have to send a request in and then prove that you have the Purple Heart. And they do quite a bit.
Yeah, I know they do. They have an organization that actually brought me to you when I was looking for somebody to appear on this show.
Well,
that's
Ron called me about it because he had two people that didn't want to get involved.
Okay.
So I don't necessarily want to get involved because Every time I turn around, they want to volunteer for something. I was working at the airport in the service section out there. And then they want me to go meet troops coming in from Afghanistan. And I said, shit, nobody met me at the beach when I got home.
Well, that's what we wanted to get at a little bit. You were wearing this medal around your neck. Tell us again. And you said you got shrapnel in one leg. And
that
then,
was in Normandy.
And then in the Battle of the Bulge?
That's right. But then between Normandy and the Battle of the Bulge, that was, June, July, August, September, October, November, December. That was 8 months. And it seemed like 8 years. And the thing I remember about most of this combat was I was hungry all the time.
Well, yeah, you were 18.
Well, in those days, each company had their kitchen. And half the time, they didn't get hot chow up to you. They kept sending rations up.
Those little cans of sea rations?
Yeah, sea rations.
What were they like?
Then later on, it would become K rations, which was a box. And you could subsist on it, but it wasn't good eating.
Well, I remember when I was a little girl that you could get this sort of World War II military surplus. The stores were everywhere, these Army Navy stores, and you could get those sea rations in the cans. And we used to eat them when we were little kids.
They stopped sea rations about, I got to stop thinking now. I retired in 73.
Uh-huh.
And that was, 40-some-odd years ago.
Uh-huh.
But in those days, you had you got meat and beans, corned beef hash, and stew.
And they all come in a wooden box, remember?
And I'd like sea rations. I mean, that was a pretty good food, but K rations. But then as we get on into August and September, when we were really trapped in Normandy.
Yeah.
Patton hadn't been released yet.
Uh-huh.
So somebody came up with a bright idea. They were going to strip bomb along this bomb line. And they did. And I remember we were hedges rose all the way around the fields. And I remember the planes came in from our right front, turned. It was a steady line of them. And when they started a strip bomb, the ground started to, like an earthquake, literally. And they strip bombed for over a half an hour. And then, of course, they got off the bomb line and they killed J. Lawton Collins, the Corps commander, and half his crew.
The Corps commander of what?
Of Third Corps.
Of our
Third Corps. But what it did, it shook the Germans up for a good mile wide, and then they turned Patton loose, and we, of course, swung down to Brittany. And then later on, we come up on the left flank to Luxembourg.
And this was Normandy Beach, right?
This was after we get out of Normandy.
Okay. Tell us about the Battle of the Bulge. What exactly is that? I keep hearing about that.
Well, I'm leading up to that.
Okay, good. Go for it.
I mean, we didn't just jump from Normandy to the Bulge.
Uh-huh.
In October, they put us in the Hurtgen Forest. Everybody said, what was that? The Hurtgen Forest, they were trying to get the Ruhr River dams. That they figured if they could blow them, they could flood the Ruhr Valley. The Hurtgen Forest chewed up 6 divisions. We went in the Hurtgen Forest with probably 12,000 men in the division, and we get out. There was only, in my platoon, there was only 12 men left out of about 30-some-odd people. And there was nothing but forest, like here, and mud. And then it started to snow. And it was just, and then from the Hurtgen, we get out of Hurtgen Forest, and we cleared to a town called Lundersdorf in Germany. And that's when the Bulge hit. north of us. And we were relieved by the 4th Division, and they sent us all the way back through Belgium, Holland, to the northern flank of the Bulge.
And what's the Bulge exactly?
The German broke through the 104th Division and was headed toward Antwerp. Mm-hmm. If they could have separated us from the British, they could have really gotten a peace treaty out of it. That was a thought anyway. And we were in the northern flank of the Bulge with the British. And the snow was probably about 14 inches, 15 inches deep all over the place. It was the coldest winter in 40 years in Europe. And we didn't have winter gear. I was lucky. I had a pair of overshoes. But anyway, it was in the morning, and we were attacked through these pine trees, and we were kind of short of people, no artillery. And I remember I was leaning by a tree because the Germans were coming from our right out because we were on the northern flank. And we walked right in between the bunch that had just left and the bunch coming up for our right. So while I was shooting at these guys up here, somebody back over here shot me in the left side of the face and head.
Oh, my God.
So from then on, they just bandaged me up, and I walked back to the aid station. And then they started the evacuation from there. Hmm. And it was funny when they sent us by train to Paris, and then from Paris they took us to Dunkirk, where we were put on a hospital ship and went to England. And every day in England, the doctors just come by and examine you, you know, and then they'd scribble something on your chart. And I had a problem with the what they call a keloid on the side of my neck. And the four doctors come by and they jab you with this needle, you know, take this brown fluid out. So they wrote something on a chart. So I got out of bed and looked at it, and they had the ZI. I said, "What in the hell is that?" And the guy says, "Just thank God it's not DY, duty. ZI is zone of the interior." So, I got shot January 14th, and the 1st of February, I was on a ship coming back to the States. So I was in the States before the war was over. Mm-hmm. I was home for both VE Day and VJ Day.
All right. You got a big thank you there. We're going to take a short break now, and we'll be back with our guests, Ira Ryan and Jack Fuller. You're listening to Hometown Alaska on KSKA.
If you missed part of today's program, or if you'd like to listen again to Hometown Alaska on KSKA, the show repeats tonight at 10. Remember, tonight's recorded rebroadcast will not be taking phone calls. Following this afternoon's broadcast, you can also find a copy of today's Hometown Alaska online at kska.org. This is KSKA Anchorage.
Welcome back to Hometown Alaska. I'm Ellen Lockyer, and today I'm speaking with guests Jack Fuller and Ira Ryan, and both are World War II veterans. Jack fought with the Marines in the South Pacific, and Ira fought in the European theater and was a one of the participants in the Normandy invasion. So, Ira, before the break, we were talking about your experiences at the Battle of the Bulge. I'd like to ask Jack a little more about his experiences on Iwo Jima, especially about the communications. Both of you were on ships when you attacked your objective. It always sort of surprises me that the ships even got in, you know, considering all the air war going on.
Well, actually, we did lose some ships at Iwo, but the method for us to get into Iwo were Amtraks and Higgins boats, and these were small crafts. But of course, lots of them took hits. But I'd like to say something to the sergeant major. He's asking people to join his Purple Heart Club. I support him 1,000%, but I'm glad I'm not qualified to join it. I went through the entire Iwo campaign without any wounds. And
was that unusual?
Well, there was a company used in the Marine Corps was about 250 men. And out of the original company, my company, B Company, there were about 24 of us left. We got replacements, of course, and stuff, but of the original, we either killed or wounded. In fact, I got a field commission after Iwo Jima because I took over when my officers were killed or wounded.
And you just did that because there was nobody else? Or?
Well, it's I was a sergeant, a buck sergeant, so I was the ranking man. And I can still, with a little bit of humor, remember my platoon sergeant. His name was Sam Justice, believe it or not. He was a real cowboy from Texas, and he was so thin and skinny, if he's sideways, you could hardly see him. But the day he was leading the platoon, because we didn't have any officers, and this was up on the second airfield, and the snipers, of course, were still knocking us off like crazy. One of them shot old Sam through the arm, and he came running back to me, and he says, "Take over, Flush. I've got the good one. I'm going home." And I swear he was hardly bleeding. I don't think he was so skinny. I don't think he had much blood. But anyway, it was under a extreme things happening, there's still some humor, you know, and I think about it, but I went through the rest of the campaign as platoon leader of my platoon, and of course I received a Silver Star for one of the happenings along the line.
Mm-hmm.
And then went out, got out of the Marine Corps at the end of the war. I went up to China.
Mm-hmm.
Which was an interesting thing.
What did you do there?
Just occupation was all. And I was with the 1st Marine Division at that time. And the Japanese were being repatriated back to Japan from Tsing Tao by another division. I think it was the 6th Marine Division. We're taking them back to Japan.
Mm-hmm.
But so
how was it at Iwo Jima when the Marines finally achieved their objective? They took back the island. I mean, what was it like then?
We had some real bad things happening. We had split the island in half and called it secured, but a group of Japs, they did not banzai, which was why we took the casualties that we took there. I can't remember his name now, the Japanese general, he said that for every Jap that died, they wanted 10 Marines. And that's, they just did not banzai, which up until then, the Japanese at a certain time, like on Guam, they get sacked up and they banzai, some of them with even sticks with a bayonet on the end of it. We called them idiot sticks, but they did these things. But at Iwo, they held their ground in their in those trenches and all the great communications. They could almost two-thirds of the island, they had connecting trenches down below. And so it was really difficult to take it.
Right, they did not like, you were saying banzai, which meant just basically kill themselves by running into enemy fire. Okay.
Yeah. And everybody thought that the Japanese in the beginning was, they couldn't fire rifles, which was, we found out that they were pretty good riflemen.
They're pretty sharp shooters. Yeah. I'd like to take this opportunity to invite our listeners to call in at 550-8433, 550-8433. If you have comments or any questions for our guests outside of Anchorage, you can call 1-888-353-5752. That's 1-888-353-5752, or email us at Hometown Alaska, one word, at kska.org. And remember that links to today's topic, which is the Pacific and European theaters in World War II, links to our information about that, our guests and about the particular topic for today can be found at KSKA's website, kska.org. So let's get back a little bit to your experiences. Jack, you went on to China to participate in the evacuation of the Japanese off of China?
Just occupation.
Occupation, okay.
But we were talking about casualties, and I'd like to put a pitch in from my general.
Okay.
Who was Graves B. Erskine's.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a one of the youngest generals in the Marine Corps, and a hero of World War One. He had 28 years in. And he said, victory was never in doubt. Its cost was. What was in doubt in all our minds was whether there would be any of us left to dedicate our cemetery at the end, or whether the last Marine would die knocking out the last Japanese gunner. And that was a quote from Iwo.
Wow, you held in there. Hold on. I'm going to take a call from Lindsay, please. Lindsay, you're on air.
Yes, hello. I appreciate hearing the stories from the gentleman. I had a grandfather, and after the war came up to Alaska and became a homesteader. And so I grew up here because of him. But luckily he made it from Iwo Jima, and it took a long time to get the stories from him, and that was the comment that I wanted to make, was to ask the gentlemen if they have been good about passing their stories on to their children and their grandchildren, because that to me has been pretty important, and I think I understand what happened for my grandfather. He was only there for 2 days, but I understand pretty well what happened, and it means a lot to me to know about that. So I appreciate the gentleman talking about it on the air.
I'm like your grandfather, okay?
Uh-huh.
How about you, Jack? I mean, how about you, Ira? Sorry.
That's what makes you feel old when somebody says, my grandfather was in the war. My grandfather was in the Civil War, and he was shot twice.
Oh, my word.
So, anyway, you know, we were talking about training a little while ago. I went in the Army in February 42, and I was in that training the division from squad to platoon to company to battalion to regiment. And then they sent us to Missouri. And there they broke half the division was sent to Europe, and the other half went to the Far East. And I went in the Army with a cousin, and I saw him last in, I think it was February 43. And when I come back in February 45, I was in a hospital in Massachusetts. And it was in Europe was over in April of 45. And there was my friend Hubie, more than my cousin, I was on leave from the hospital in Massachusetts. And I went back. I got back late. It was about midnight. And the nurse said, we just got a load in from the Pacific, so there's one bed left on the other side. So I went over and crawled in bed. And who's in bed next to me in the morning but Hubie Richter? And I got shot in the left side of my head in the bulge, and he got shot on Okinawa. But his went in through the chin.
Oh, my goodness.
So Hubie and I... Okay.
That's okay. That's all right. I'm not interrupting. I was signaling our tech. Okay. Let's go to Marie. Hold on air. Marie, you're on air.
Thank you. I would like to have him talk a little bit about the medics that were... my dad was a corpsman that went into Guadalcanal and Normandy, but he never talked too much about it. So,
pardon me.
He was shot a few times, so I'm sure he had a little bit to do with the medics.
I'll tell you what. I don't think there's a Marine alive that wouldn't say that the medics, the Navy medics, are the bravest guys that they ever met in their life. Because when the Marines are all got their heads down in the sand, and that medic, that great guy, goes out and pulls them in and patches them up. And we lost a lot of medics at Iwo, and they were our brothers.
It was the same way in the Army. If somebody yelled medic, he's the guy to get up and ran over to where the wounded was. So we were the same way. We had three or four medics in my platoon.
My Uncle George was a medic in World War II and in Europe. When I do this, I'm signaling for the...
But, you know, she said that my kids, they're all in their 40s now, the three of them. And they hear something and they say, well, you never talk about it. I said, well, why should I talk about it? And occasionally Frank, the oldest one, is 50, he'll say, Jesus, why didn't you tell me about that? I said, we hit the brag.
I'm getting a lot of calls. Carol, you're on air. Carol?
First of all, thank you for taking my call. And number two, gentlemen, both of you, thank you very much for your service to the country. I would like to have some information, please, contact information with the Wounded Veteran Program, if you have that.
I don't have it right here with me. I'm sorry. But if there's some way you can give it to the station here, I'll certainly see that you get it.
Well, we could put that on our website, Carol. Is there
Sounds
a wounded
great.
Veterans program for, is it under the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs?
It's an organization.
Okay.
It's a separate organization.
Okay.
I'll get it.
We'll find that out. We'll put it on our KSKA.org website, okay?
Thank you.
Thanks, Carol. Thanks for calling in. Let's go to line two, Bill. Bill, you're on air.
Yes, thank you. And I'd like to make a statement and have the gentleman make a comment. And first I want to give him a thank you. And my father was in the Pacific Theater, Saipan. And when I grew up, I was grew up around all these World War II veterans, and not one of them ever mentioned the war, what they did. And if they did, it was only the humorous, the good times they remembered. But my statement to these two gentlemen is that people don't realize that if it wouldn't have been for you guys and all of the military men that went over there, we'd be speaking German or Japanese, and there wouldn't have, America would never have been as great, and there wouldn't have been anything for these greedsters to steal from us. So I'd like these gentlemen to comment on the fact of that, because the way America has gone, it breaks my heart, and it has to break everyone else's heart who had relatives in World War II. And thank you.
Okay, well, thanks for calling, Bill. Go ahead.
First of all, your dad was in a a real tough campaign. A lot of people don't realize all the casualties that were taken at Saipan. That was a real tough deal. And I want to say that I'm a little, like you are, apprehensive of what's happening in this country today. I think that's one reason I'm here today. As a, I don't normally do this sort of thing, and I think that we got to get back to God and country real fast, or we're in deep doo doo.
How about you, Ira?
I agree 100%. We were raised in a different style of life than the most of the people that are in their, even their 40s today. And we need much more support. Look at the voting. It was less than, 30% to this election yesterday? Even the presidential elections are slow. People just don't care, but they're the biggest complainers. So you've got to get out and do your thing.
That's a great point. You would think with the amount of communication we have today, you would have to be absolutely asleep all the time to not know what was going on. But you're right, it has seemed to create more apathy than anything else. How about, Ira, you re-enlisted, or how did that work? You went to Korea, you went to Vietnam. What motivated you to stay in the Army?
I got out on the 6th of October, 45, and I wanted to go to diesel engineering school, but there was a mess up somewhere along the line. So before my 90 days was up, I went into the recruiter and I said, "Where do you got open?" He says, "Where do you want to go?" And I said, "Well, what do you got choice do I have?" He says, "You have three choices." He says, "You can go to Europe, Far East, or Alaska." And I said, "Oh my!" I said, "Alaska." I said, "By God, I was in the Army with a guy from Alaska, and he used to tell me about shooting moose in the backyard and the streams filled with salmon." So he said, "Okay, we'll put you down for Alaska." Well, make a long story short, my orders come down for Europe. So I went right back to Europe. And I spent 3 years in Berlin. And I came back. Then they had me escorting war dead. And I put in for another Alaska again. And Europe, the third trip. So I had three back-to-back trips to Europe, then Korea, and then I came back from Korea, and then I was stationed in Maryland, and that's when I got out of the infantry and went into air defense. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the reasons why I wound up here in Alaska. Mm-hmm. And it was 70 before I finally got my choice.
Well, you probably were spared the battle of Attu. You mentioned earlier that you were lucky that you had a pair of boots in Europe during the Battle of the Bulge. But apparently, the soldiers sent to Attu Island in Alaska for that particular battle were dressed in like desert gear, and they didn't have proper footwear, and they got frostbite.
Trench foot.
Uh-huh.
It was. Well, I see photos of World War II in Europe, and I can usually spot somebody that's been placing clothing up for, I had a couple towels I wore around my neck instead of a scarf. And they were slow in getting stuff to us, the same way with replacements. My platoon sergeant got shot in the town called Lundersdorf, right at the edge of the Hurricane Forest. And he got shot twice in the upper arm.
Mm-hmm.
And I was called back. They said, "You got some replacements." So I went back to the company headquarters to pick my... I got four people. And all four of them had infantry training. But three of them were photo interpreters out of the Air Force. In those days, it was still part of the Army. And the other guy had been in the quartermaster outfit back on the beach. and they were just scarfing anybody up, sending them forward, because they thought the war would be over by this time, and it wasn't so.
I wanted to get at what the treatment was when you came home. We talked a little bit earlier about how the Vietnam vets were not treated well when they came home. How was it coming back from World War II as a, you know?
Well, I'll tell you, when I got back to the States, the war was over in Europe in April. I got back at the end of February. So we landed in Newport News. And there was still a brownout because of the U-boats working. And the war was still on, so they put us on a hospital train and took us up to, and nobody was cheering and yelling, you know, welcome home and the rest of it, you know. So I really can't say we had a big greeting.
Right, you were sort of part of the landscape. How about you, Jack?
Well,
what was it like when you came home?
Actually... When I came home from World War II, if you went into a bar, a serviceman, you couldn't buy a drink. I mean, everybody was just positively for you all the way, and that's why I've always felt so bad that the shame on this country of the way they treated Vietnam vets when they come home. I think it's something that we have to live with, but it's a sad story as far as I'm concerned.
Mm-hmm. Well, it was the same way in Korea. When I come back from Korea, nobody cheers, you know. Some friend of mine says, "Where have you been?" I said, "Korea." He said, "Korea, Korea, Korea." I had a reminder that we just finished a shoot match over there.
It wasn't like MASH.
God forbid, no.
No.
MASH was a...
I mean, speaking of, you know, entertainment value of a hideous conflict, I mean, that was probably one of the all-time most popular TV shows ever.
Well, I was lucky in Korea. I was a heavy weapons mortarman. And we had 4.2 mortars. And let's see, B Company, I was in the 3rd Platoon, we had four deuce mortars in our... And, of course, we were behind the lines. We supported, one time, the British. We supported the Koreans. We supported the Ethiopians. They had a battalion over there in Korea.
Wow.
I mean, it was strictly the Turks. They were the ones to support because they gave no ground. They lost few prisoners. And... they were quite an outfit.
Korea, the Ethiopians were over there? I didn't know that. It's like the...
Oh, yeah, the Ethiopians, they were all... They must have had to walk under... They were all about 6 foot tall and really had the Israeli look, so to speak. You could tell they were Jewish, the lost tribe of Israel.
Oh, they're very pretty people. I actually know a few Ethiopians, strangely enough. But we are running out of time, gentlemen. And I'd like to thank my guests, Jack Fuller, Marine, and Mr. Ira Ryan of the U.S. Military Army Infantry. And I'm Ellen Lockyer, your host for Hometown Alaska. Don't forget, tune in next Wednesday when Tika Ballas will talk to you about teaching in the bush. Pat Yak is APTI's Vice President of News and Public Media. Kristen Spack engineered today's program with assistance from Constance Huff. And I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Hometown Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated News and Public Media. An archived copy of today's program, additional information, and links to all the websites mentioned on today's show are available online at kska.org. Send us your comments and suggestions of things you'd like to talk about at Hometown Alaska, 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508. This is KSKA Anchorage.